I'm Maria Titizian, and you're listening to Examining the Context, a podcast by EVN Report. In this episode, we take a close look at the looming threat of Russian interference in Armenia's 2026 parliamentary elections. The big question isn't if the Kremlin will try to interfere, but how far it's willing to go. What tools will it use? How much pressure will it apply? And what does this mean for Armenia's already fragile democracy? Joining me is Dr. Nerses Kopalyan, political scientist, international security expert, and author of EVN Report's monthly EVN Security Report. His April briefing, titled Subversion and Electoral Interference, Russia and Armenia's 2026 Elections, outlines the tactics Moscow may deploy as it recalibrates its regional ambitions. Nerses, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here, Maria.
And it's great having you in Yerevan instead of doing this online.
Always great being in Yerevan.
So, drawing parallels with Moldova's recent experience, you look at the tools of hybrid warfare, the role of Armenia's what you call illiberal opposition, and the vulnerabilities in the country's economic and political structures. And you also distinguish between two threat domains: Azerbaijan as a primary actor in physical security threats, that's very clear, and also Russia as a central player in hybrid and information warfare. Can you walk us through what Russia's interference in Armenia's upcoming parliamentary elections next year might look like, and what tools and strategies Moscow is likely to employ and is already sort of employing without us really realizing it at times?
Of course. So what we've seen is that the Kremlin has developed a playbook where in countries that in which they have lost certain levels of influence or diminishing soft power or sort of, you know, the traditional levers of affecting developments there, and these tend to be generally nascent or transitional democracies, they have instrumentalized specific hybrid tactics and cyber tactics to interfere in the electoral process of those countries. So while they have a wider-ranging hybrid game plan with these specific countries, electoral periods and elections themselves provide fertile grounds for more of an aggressive engagement by Russia. These are what we call basically, you know, windows of opening for intense hybrid attacks. And most democracies or developing democracies tend to be at their most vulnerable during electoral cycles. And so while they're trying to demonstrate their democratic prowess, at the same time, any activity by the Russians or any other state that tries to basically harm the democratic institutions, culture, and process of a given country, and these become basically sort of, you know, ripe opportunities for them to do so. The reason why I utilized Moldova as a case study is because we have to have something empirical to go off of, right? You know, very common approach is to basically speculate in Armenia or sort of, you know, assume what things could look like. But we do have a concrete understanding of how Russia operationalizes its subversive and electoral interference thing toolkit. We saw recently something happen in Romania similarly. We had seen Moldova prior to that. But within the domain of comparatively understanding the similarities between the systems and structures that Moscow will seek to influence, we see that Moldova is very, very similar to Armenia. Whether it's the structure of local politics, whether it's the presence of Russian troops within a vicinity of the given countries, whether it's the energy dependence of both, whether it's the large influence, whether overt or covert, of Russian business interests or Russian-aligned business interests in the both systems, so on and so forth. And of course, both have also demonstrated a very strong preference for tilting or shifting towards the West, possibly EU candidacy, so on and so forth. So when we see a lot of structural similarities between the two, Moldova becomes a very healthy case study for us to observe and understand the toolkit and the mechanisms that Russia utilized. And then based on that, and also observing the last 3 years and the track record of Russian operations here, for us to triangulate that the broader methods that they're going to be using come 2026. So what I did with this piece is we did a bit of an in-depth study of both understanding the tactics that Russia utilizes at a conceptual level, and then we bring that down to an actual on-the-ground specific cases of how Russia would do this, while at the same time observing developments that are coming out of Moscow. So what we've seen is Moscow has actually put together, the Kremlin has put together an elite team that was that's going to be covering the 2026 elections in Armenia. And the team that the Kremlin put together is the same team that basically ran the referendums and elections in Luhansk and Donetsk. It's the same team that recently ran or affected developments in Abkhazia. And this is the same team that basically carried out the game plan in Moldova. And so in this context, we have sufficient knowledge of the individuals that are going to basically that form this team. And these tend to be the elite of Russia's electoral interference groupings and the tactics that they use. So at a broader level, right, we see Russia utilizing four general approaches when it comes to subversion and electoral interference. The first, we discussed this in the article, is how they utilize sort of these multiple synchronized tools that create linear and non-linear effects. Now, what does this mean, right? Linear effects would be sort of, you know, us observing a continuous Russian information warfare, for example. That's linear. If there's continuity, we could pick it up, right? A non-linear would be, for example, them immediately blocking off access to energy, or them out of the blue creating unexpected economic blockades or boycotting Armenian goods or things of that sort, right? So those are non-linear. And then you might see, for example, you know, low-level or linear or hybrid attacks or cyber attacks, but then you might see unexpectedly a non-linear massive attack on, for example, Armenia's healthcare system or water management systems or whatever the case might be, right? So these look at times may not immediately seem synchronized to us, but it is for them because it's part of a long-term strategy. Next, they are very good at creating sort of this ambiguity, right? A plausible deniability is a very important thing. For example, most can tell that, you know, the hidden Russian hand is beyond some operations, but it's very, very difficult to put one's finger on it and to demonstrate and prove this, okay? And so what this does is relying on plausible deniability allows Russia to enhance its hybrid operations while at the same time preserving for itself that degree of protection from being accused of those kinds of operations.
So he would utilize, let's say, public intellectuals, bloggers. Are you talking about the information space here or in general?
That is one component of it. For example, you know, it's an open secret that Russia supported the Robert Kocharyan, you know, alliance in the 2021 elections, right? So that did not need any plausible deniability because their interests aligned. But we also know, because there's ample information that's really not publicly discussed, that the Bagrat Serpazhan movement also had a lot of Russian influence and support, even funding. But drawing a direct connection between those kinds of public unrest or attempts at destabilization and the Kremlin is very, very difficult, right? Within this context, this ambiguity, this plausible deniability allows the Kremlin to basically, you know, remove itself from any responsibility or being subjected at direct accusations, while at the same time being able to achieve their objectives. The same thing happened in Romania. The same thing happened in Moldova. The same thing we have seen happen in different countries in the West. Even in the U.S. We saw this in France, even in Mexico, so on and so forth, where it's very evident that a Kremlin connected groups or groups that have certain affiliation to various other groups that are also connected to the Kremlin, so on and so forth. So there's this chain of evidence that leads to nowhere, but the overarching connections, scope of operations are very, very evident. But what that does is, again, it allows for plausible deniability. And so this is a very, very important technique that they use. Now, both of these approaches, right, are designed to achieve their third objective, and that is to sort of exploit the seams, the fabric of democratic society. Because if you can produce fracture instability in nascent or transitional democracies, you fundamentally harm, right, their trajectory for consolidation. And what that does is that basically allows Russia to potentially achieve its objectives.
Right, because it might not be able to impact the final outcome of the election, but that might not even be their objective.
Correct. So from the, you know, long-term objectives of these kinds of operations, they might not be able to affect, you know, the elections that are coming up this year next year, right? But the collateral damage, the side effects of what happens 4 years from now, 5 years from now at the next elections, it might have different results. And so their objective is always the long-term game. right? The more fracture and instability you create, the further you slow down the consolidation process. And then there comes a point where you could completely rupture the consolidation process, where the given country is a democracy that remains continuously transitional. So they stay in sort of this purgatory of not being able to consolidate as a democracy, but also demonstrating, you know, underdeveloped institutions. And so a big part of this approach supports that. And the fourth one is Russia has a very unique ability of deploying sort of, you know, what we call distraction elements to achieve these objectives that we're talking about. And one of the distraction elements they excel at are developing and instigating culture wars, right, within given societies.
Mm-hmm. How would that look like in Armenia, though?
Right. So in Armenia, right, we've already seen some of it, mm-hmm. The cultural war between or attempted cultural war or these sort of, you know, some levels of polarization we see between those that argue that sectors of Armenian society are pro-Turkish, that they want to sell the thing, parts of the country to foreign agents or foreign powers, that these forces are trying to basically deny Armenian history, deny Armenian identity, right? You engage in identity politics, you engage in culture wars. And Russia is very good at tapping into that because they have a very deep understanding of Armenian culture.
Yeah, interestingly, you said that, you know, Russia has a intimate knowledge almost of Armenian culture, identity issues. But not only that, I mean, there's also influential Armenians living in Russia that are being operationalized, perhaps, are they, by the Kremlin?
Most definitely. This is very similar.
You know, we've seen statements by some very, you know, wealthy oligarchs
who live
in Russia.
Basically, speaking Kremlin talking points. Yeah. So we saw something very, very similar in Moldova, right? What we saw was Russia and Kremlin operatives working very closely with local proxies and oligarchs or former oligarchs within the economic system in Moldova that basically help destabilize or engage in vote buying or other types of activities that allowed for robust electoral interference. And so Armenia's post-Velvet system has a lot of these similarities. Indeed, most of the previous oligarchs that Armenia had prior to the Velvet are in exile in Moscow. And all of their wealth is basically going to be utilized at some level to affect or influence developments here. Also, we see that there's a very important level of interconnection between existing business interests in Armenia, who did quite well prior to the Velvet Revolution, and they're sort of this loose network that they have that connects them to the previous oligarchs as well. And so while these, you know, business interests in Armenia, and I can't, you know, I'm not saying this forms the entirety of the market. That's not what we're talking about. But a healthy chunk of it is present, right? Because, you know, a lot of wealth was accrued prior to the Velvet, and this didn't evaporate. So this has been, you know, invested in much of Armenia's economy. And those who have made those investments and control those investments, while they have presented a certain posturing of political neutrality, we know very well that when push comes to shove, their leaning will be towards sort of, you know, the previous oligarchic interest and a loose network through which they made a lot of their money, and a preference to political influence or an outcome that is more commensurate with Russian interests. And so those circles remain ripe for these kinds of operations that we're talking about.
So those are the interests that have, you know, migrated, if you will, to Russia. But the proxies that you talk about in Armenia, this is not ideational or ideological, is it? Or is it mostly
financial? It's a combination
financial?
Of both. So what you have is, the political parties that what we qualify as the illiberal opposition that are basically vocally pro-Russian, or some are even talking about joining a union state with Russia or emulating Belarus. That's ideological and very, very straightforward.
Is it though? Is it purely ideological?
Yes, it's ideological in the sense that they believe that their own personal self-interest as individuals or stakeholders, and also from their lens, Armenia as a political entity, is safer and better served in a non-democratic partnership with Russia under the tutelage and protection of Russia, regardless of concerns of democracy.
Which allows the money to flow into their pockets, though.
Precisely. No? But from their lens, they think that that system of governance is still safer for Armenia than any other alternative. And of course, yes, it's a fusion of, you know, given elite interests masquerading as the national interest. Nonetheless, there are important ideational factors there as well. They just simply view that Russia is the dominant actor historically and in the future of the region. And so being a Russian vassal is the preferred ideological leaning for them. And so that is their paradigm. And so those interests, right, specifically in the electoral domain, lean heavily towards supporting Russia, and they do serve as proxies. The economic interests that we were talking about, they are obviously integrated with some of these activities. To a large extent, their approach might not be ideological, right? But they might, of course, be incentivized. You know, in the article, I talked about how just for the local elections in 2023, Russia fused in over 55 million into Moldova's elections, right, to basically engage in vote buying, influence business interests, corporate interests, you know, oligarchic interests to advance Russia's goals and i.e. disrupt the electoral process. And then in the 2024 presidential election, they basically infused in more than $100 million for these operations. So if you're a local businessman or whatever the case might be that is loosely connected to this network, right, your approach might not be ideational or ideological. It can potentially be incentivized through economic offerings. So it's a fusion of both, to answer your question. But it does not make it any less dangerous to the danger of destabilization and democratic harm.
Okay, so given the changes in Armenia's security and sort of state institutions since 2020, since 2018, how prepared is the country to counteract potential hybrid threats, maintain electoral integrity?
It's definitely a lot more prepared now than it was, for the 21 elections, which interestingly...
But the results... of those elections.
But we have to be honest about this. The Russian interference was a lot more limited in 2021. It was
Why?
A lot more tempered. It could be a combination of things. Russia was operating under the logic that, you know, post-war society,
Would not re-elect a leader. Security
versus democracy, and they were operating under the logic that, right, the illiberal opposition would perform much better than they had anticipated.
Right.
And so they saw the political field as ripe for an organic change as opposed to them expanding resources. And clearly Russia was caught off guard of how the elections went. And so for 2026, they're not going to take the same risk. Also, I quote the Moscow Times article in our security report that basically talks about, what Moscow is publicly sharing about their intentions and how they're putting together their objectives in enhancing, quote-unquote, Russian soft power in Armenia. And what becomes very clear is that they concede that they are not going to make the same mistake in 2026 that they made in 2021. They concede that individuals like Robert Kocharyan and Serzh Sarkisian are not viable candidates to advance Russian interests. So they will serve as local proxies that can destabilize or create complications for democratic consolidation, but these are not going to be the individuals that are going to produce the results that Russia seeks. So they see the existing political parties that are pro-Russia as agents of destabilization, as opposed to having the capacity to win, to produce electoral outcomes. But again, if you keep sowing doubt, fracture, instability within the democratic process, sooner, what we're going to see is a possible development by 2030 or 2031, whatever the case might be, where the democratic forces are exhausted, that the consistent hybrid attacks, the consistent fracture, polarization also exhausts Armenian society. And this is where illiberal populist leaders or well-funded movements are able to tap into that environment and produce electoral results. This is kind of similar what we saw in Romania last week with the electoral outcome in the first round. And so whether it fails the first time or the second time, right, doesn't mean that 5 years from now or 8 years from now or whatever, the results will be different. So from Russia's lens, this is a very low investment process that could have high yield results down the line. And so when we look at large powers like Russia who view regional developments through sort of these grand strategies, a 5 to 10 year trajectory for them is not a long time. And so whatever the results are in 2025, for them, how much fracture, how much polarization, how much rupturing of the social fabric did they achieve, and how would that affect the next elections in 2030 or 31? This tends to be kind of their approach.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking about, you know, after the war and during the 2021 elections or leading up to that, there was this constant chatter, narrative in the public discourse about security versus democracy. And that all of a sudden stopped. So it's interesting. I mean, who pushed that narrative, right?
Right.
And now all of a sudden it's off the agenda. So do you know what I'm saying?
So these kinds of waves of narrative construction are not uncommon. Mm-hmm. Russia excels at it. The group that they have put together to deal with Armenia in 2026, as I mentioned, one of them is an ideological. He is someone who basically developed as a tactician in constructing ideological movements and tapping into the cultural wars. So in 2021, Russia was convinced. A lot of people were convinced that the democracy versus a security discourse was going to work and that security from their lens, quote-unquote security, was going to win. But of course, EVN report, we did a poll that suggested otherwise, and these proved to be correct. We also saw that in the most vulnerable villages on the border areas, they voted landslide for the Democratic candidate as opposed to the so-called security candidate. So what we understood was that while Russia shaped what may have appeared to have been a strong narrative, they truly did not understand the thinking or the political pulse of Armenian society. And so in 2026, right, they're going to be changing the approach. It's no longer going to be about, obviously, security versus democracy, but it's going to be things such as, the decay of Armenia's values, the decay of Armenian's sort of, relevance as a society. It's going to be identity politics. It's going to be cultural wars. This is what they're going to be tapping into, right? Faith versus, Western influence.
Yeah, the pro-Turkey so narrative.
So on and so forth.
Right,
Now, the difference between that and what we saw in 2021 is that this could be more multifaceted, right? So one individual, for example, might not buy the identity politics, but they might buy into sort of, the underperformance of the government, or they might buy into the logic of concessions, or they might buy into X, Y, and Z. So the approach is going to be well-constructed and multi-tiered. It's going to be, a well-developed, multifaceted information and hybrid attack against Armenia. And the information warfare has already started, right? When you have, for example, the newly elected mayor of Gyumri talking about Armenia joining a union state with Belarus, which has nothing to do with local municipal elections, we see an attempt at narrative construction. And so they're going to be attempting to popularize these kinds of postures. And so we're going to see that, generally speaking, there's going to be a testing of narratives, what works and what doesn't.
Will resonate, what
exactly
will stick.
The Kremlin is very good at this. What most don't realize is that the individual that has been, tapped to lead this initiative from the Kremlin is by his training a methodologist. And so the models that they used in the 2018 elections in Russia, in the 2020 plebiscite in Russia, they relied heavily, it was heavily data-driven. And so we expect similar outcomes here, where they will rely on actual empirical findings to decide how the strategies that they're going to develop for maximum efficacy.
How significant do you think the role of media and information dissemination will be in Russia's strategy? And what measures can we take, can Armenia take, to bolster its information security?
I think media is going to be exceptionally important.
Yeah.
Because when we look at the domain of hybrid attacks or information warfare being successful or having less success, what we see is that there's a very statistically strong relationship between media literacy, how society absorbs information, and how the media proliferates information. In Armenia, it's hard to speak of professional journalism or of the media, with the exception of the independent media outlets that we see, which happen to be quite few. So if you look at, for example, the media that is oligarch-owned or owned by certain Russian interests or Russian-aligned oligarchs or the Korcharians and the Sarkisians, so on and so forth, they don't report news. They basically proliferate talking points from the Kremlin or from their leadership. In Armenia, we call that news or we call that media, but that's not exactly what it is, right? Similarly, while not at that level, media outlets that are also connected to the government tend to basically proliferate the talking points of the party in power. But this is a lot less mitigated because they do address, you know, institutional factors, developmental factors, because the government in power or the party in power also represents the state. The information that they put out there is more subjected to more scrutiny by the citizens than those from the opposing forces. But nonetheless, right, what you're going to see is an enhanced attempt at basically saturating and overwhelming Armenia's media ecosystem by the Russians.
Yeah, and I would even argue, Narses, it's not even, you know, sort of the legacy media or even, you know, independent media outlets or any,
right,
whatever we consider media. It's, you know, YouTubers and vloggers, and they have huge
resources.
So the question that always comes to, that sort of tortures my mind is, why is it that such a large segment or significant segment of our society is willing to listen to these so-called YouTubers or opinion shapers who are just engaged in gossip and you know, nefarious,
right,
statements? How does any society then?
Right. So, okay. So let me kind of provide underlying context to your question on what we've learned and what we're expecting the Russians to do. Okay. So we know that, you know, after 3 years of experience, Russia is going to be utilizing approximately 6 different operational tools. One of them, you noted, right? Information manipulation. We've seen examples in other countries of civil society subversion. We see a lot of what we call malign finance, right? Sort of these opaque financing techniques where money is poured into a country to support, you know, destabilization efforts, but it's really difficult for the given country to trace them, mm-hmm, or control it, right? Cyber attacks, of course, are part of the game quite clearly, and also economic coercion or other kinetic activities. For Armenia, the biggest threat, as you noted, is going to be information manipulation. And to that, I add cyber attacks and malign financing. Now, when we look at sort of, you know, different techniques that other countries have used to sort of, you know, attempt to stave off these information attacks or opaque financing techniques, Armenia is going to have a difficult time in controlling for malign financing because there's a lot of economic trade and interrelations with the Russians. There's still a very important part of Armenian society that receives, you know, money that is transferred back home from, you know,
labor migrants,
transit laborers and labor migrants from Russia. So controlling for that is going to be relatively difficult. Also, Armenia's institutions, I mean, you know, developed societies struggle with this. Armenia's institutions aren't that sufficiently developed and that highly professionalized to catch all of these. Some of it will get caught, obviously, but the majority of it is going to be very, very difficult. Even the Moldovans, with all the support they got from the Europeans to kind of address that problem, they also struggled with it. So malign finance is going to be a problem. But within a domain of information warfare, right, we see two techniques that really work and enhance resiliency. One, media literacy campaigns, and two, preemptive information campaigns by the government. Okay. Media literacy campaigns are generally driven by media outlets and civil society, right? Where the citizen learns and understands that if the source of information is X, then you should not believe it and take it with a grain of salt, as opposed to the citizen not even understanding these kinds of nuances and absorbing that anything that's been put out there. With respect to the information campaign coming out of the government, right, the government's responsibility is going to be part of the process of educating citizens and preparing them for potential outcomes, right? So, you know, if you have, for example, educational programs on the news or public television or whatever the case might be that exposes the public to these kinds of things, purely on an informational and empirical level, that enhances the knowledge base and understanding of the population and allows them to better process such information when they are subjected to an information warfare that they otherwise would not understand. So in Armenia, for example, there's a general understanding that, yes, there is an information warfare being implemented against Armenian society. So most members of society, if you ask them, is there information warfare? They'll say, yes, of course. But if you ask them, for example, give us an example of what this entails, they will struggle. It's not their fault, obviously, right? So this is the lack of being educated or informed about what these processes entail. So the government's responsibility would be at a very at a technical level, right? At a sort of educational level, to provide civic education so citizens understand this. There's a reason why expansive Russian operations against Estonia, against the Baltics, against the Finns have not worked. Because these are societies that have a lot of media literacy, and the government puts in a lot of resources in civic education and informing them how to navigate, right, information attacks, information warfare. So that remains sort of one of the more important approaches. On the other hand, we have seen, for example, examples from Moldova that you can reach out to your partners for support on these, right?
Right. You're right about that, and I was going to ask you, but then, yeah, go ahead.
Right. So when it comes to combating, you know, cyber attacks, right, Armenia clearly does not have the capacity on its own to stave off a Russian attack. We do fairly well with Azerbaijan, but the Russian capacity and toolkit is completely beyond our capabilities. So how useful can Western partners be? How useful can private industry be in this project? So we saw Moldova use a fusion of these, and it had some effect, but Armenia could most definitely learn from this and basically preempt by creating, by developing a strong guardrail against potential attacks.
Okay, what do you mean by private sector expertise here?
We know, we generally assume that this all this responsibility is within the domain of the government, right? This isn't really the case. In the United States, for example, in Europe, and various other countries, from South Korea all the way to Australia, you have huge corporations, mm-hmm. right? IT corporations, information software corporations that support the government in developing cyber defensive capabilities. So Armenia right now clearly does not have those capabilities to stave off a Russian cyber attack or waves of those. And so contracting and bringing in the private sector, corporations that know how to do this, how they can support Armenia to develop these capabilities and possibly run some of the cyber defense and security capabilities of Armenia would definitely enhance it. So this is what we mean by tapping into the a private sector, because, you know, you have these multinational corporations that basically this is what they do. They're exceptionally good at it. Whereas you have developing societies that are trying to get there, but they know that they're nowhere close to having the capabilities of these, you know, multinational corporations that fundamentally deal with cybersecurity, cyber defense. So contracting those kinds of private sector multinational corporations to enhance, support, and supplement the vulnerabilities that you have in defending your cyber domain is kind of what we're talking about.
Narcisse, do you think at this point Armenia's government, state institutions, which we know, you know, are rather weak still, and some of them, especially the power structures, have Russian influence still within its ranks, perhaps? What about Armenian civil society? I mean, is it still resilient? I feel like there's general fatigue. Yeah, and you mentioned that, you know, at some point you're going to be exhausted. Right now, do we have, or what should be prioritized in terms of tools to counter this hybrid threat by Russia?
Let me just kind of address your first point you made. Russia's influence in Armenia's security apparatus has actually diminished. This is why, if you see the game plan that Russia is putting together, none of it entails attempting to influence Armenian institutions, because Russia no longer has any presence in Armenia's foreign ministry. Their presence in the security apparatus, whether it's the new Foreign Intelligence Service.
What about the National Security Service?
Whether it's the MOD, is diminished. In the National Security Service, they used to have a lot of influence.
Where aren't most of them trained in Russia still?
They were trained in Russia, definitely. But what we've seen is that, and this is maybe a subject of conversation for a different podcast, but by 2026, what we're going to see is the laws that were passed, the entirety of responsibility that the NSS has with respect to foreign intelligence is going to be transferred to the Foreign Intelligence Service. So these structural changes that were undertaken in Armenia basically diminishes whatever pockets of institutional support that the Russians may have been able to rely on. So at the institutional level, indeed, while Armenia's institutions are still developing, they are nowhere that they need to be. That is well taken. but the Russian influence has exponentially diminished. So they cannot tap into that like the way they were able to in the past. As far as, the resiliency of civil society on this, that's a very, very good question. There's two ways of kind of conceptualizing this. One, precisely, is the fatigue discourse, right? Is Armenia's civil society exhausted by constantly having to address or deal in a two-front war? On the one hand, it has sort of the anti-democratic forces that it tries to deal with, but at the other hand, it has the responsibility of, regardless of who the government power is, to hold fire to their feet and make sure that the powers that be are transparent and responsible. So whereas, prior to the Velvet Revolution, Armenia's civil society had one responsibility: combating authoritarianism and basically seeking to change the non-democratic trajectory. Post-Velvet Revolution, their responsibilities are multi-tiered, right? Because it's not a single target that they're working on. So civil society in Armenia, we can say, while still remains relatively vibrant and strong, is overstretched. And this is very common in transitional democracies because you have more responsibilities, right? You're dealing with social issues, information issues, so on and so forth. Now, on top of that, you add waves of hybrid attacks that are coming, and you ask civil society, aside from all the things that you're working on, from, for example, domestic violence to disability rights to et cetera, on top of that, you ask civil society, we want you to now be the vanguard for the public in combating information warfare that's going to come. It's going to be a tall task. So one school can address the fatigue problem. The other, however, when we look at this, is the motivational factor. Civil society, when confronted with severe threats to democracy, right, severe threats to the values that it holds dear, tends to mobilize and creates a singular front to fight off that single threat that it sees coming. So in that context, while the fatigue factor is there, there's also the mobilization and resiliency factor. Because it's one thing, as I noted, to ask civil society to do 15 things. But it's another thing when civil society observes a severe threat to the democracy that they've fought, decades to achieve. And when they see a threat towards that, demobilization factor also enhances. So we are going to see how well they operate in 2026, and also the extent to which the government enables and gives them resources to do this.
Mm-hmm. But look what happened in Georgia. But that's a whole other podcast.
Absolutely.
Which we're not going to get into. But there's also one other factor that we might not be taking into consideration, is if there's a severe economic downturn in the
right,
how that's going to impact everything.
Absolutely.
Because look, you're talking about civil society, but this is only my perception, and I could be really wrong. I don't see new blood coming into civil society structures. Seeing the old guard there mostly still trying to fight the good fight, who seem to be fatigued. I'm just wondering if there's new blood coming in, and then what happens if there's a severe economic recession ahead of 2026.
Your first point is well taken indeed. How well of a job is civil society doing in recruiting new talent, right? Filling in its ranks? Have they become sort of these stagnant organizations that fight the good fight, but they became limited in their capacity? Again, it goes back to the same point that because in democracies, all the things that you want to fight for under an authoritarian regime do not exist, the sense of, motivation and collective anger that is common in civil society to fight authoritarianism, you don't have that in a democracy. So if an average individual, a university graduate, an authoritarian regime would have very likely joined civil society, now they look at things and they're like, we're a democracy in process. There's really nothing for me to go on the streets and fight for. So I'll
be
proceed,
a programmer and
right,
make
I'll,
good
I'll
money.
Right, I'll proceed with a certain career path.
Sure.
And so these are some
That's
of the things.
That's my concern, yeah.
Yeah, but those individuals mobilizing and returning to the streets to defend something that they truly believe in should also not be discounted. With respect to your second point, which is an excellent point, in the scholarship, we call this an exogenous factor, right? Or an intervening variable, if you will. And these are basically developments that you have consideration for, but they're not the defining variable with respect to these kinds of things. And most definitely, if there is some kind of an economic downturn, early 2026, that affects cost of living, affects standard of living in Armenia, the Kremlin or the local proxy or the opposition is able to tap into that, this government will have severe problems because, you know, most transitional democracies, because they went from an illiberal regime to an open market regime, the economy grows very, very quickly. So a lot of the successful relationship we see between post-democratic breakthrough governments and their success rates is that the economy does really, really well, right, relatively speaking. And so if the economy stagnates or the economy
tanks,
recedes, right, and you have some kind of a recession, then the pocketbook vote that they could have relied on is no longer there. And this makes the electoral field and much of society more ripe for culture wars, which makes the whole thing more susceptible. So most definitely economic downturns are something to keep in mind. Of course, when we look at the trajectories being put out there by the IMF or the World Bank, et cetera, Armenia still stands to undergo,
yeah, there's a little bit of
growth, but right, with
stagnation,
you know,
though, as
with
well.
Things in the United States and sure. then the tariff wars, the trade wars, etc., we never really cannot 100% be certain mm-hmm. how the global economic system might be disrupted. And if there is such a disruption and its effect on Armenia or, you know, more than anticipated, that could definitely create severe problems. So exogenous factors are something that we definitely take into consideration.
Final question. Beyond the 2026 elections, whatever happens, yeah? We know something is going to happen. What long-term strategies should Armenia's government adopt to safeguard its democratic institutions from external subversion? Do we come back to like media literacy, public education?
Yeah, those things we discussed, but yeah. I think Armenia's, you know, the government and ruling party are two different things, but I think Armenia's government has to produce, you know, educational programs that promote pluralism and sort of, you know, diversity of political parties in the electoral system. Because, you know, the more pluralism that you have, the more allies you have that can combat these kinds of operations. But if it's a single party that represents the democratic wing and the entirety of the local proxies, the hidden economic interests and the hybrid attack targets them, that limits their capacity, right? So imagine if you have 5, 4, 6 competitive democratic parties that are in parliament or have a chance of getting into parliament, their effect and influence on society is going to be different. Whereas you have a single party that's trying to do everything and you cannot monopolize the entire electoral field to quote unquote fight the good fight. So pluralism, institutionalized pluralism is a very, very important aspect. Second, you know, we talk about resiliency extensively, but the institutions of Armenia have to be strengthened. Okay, you lose information warfare because you're not able to combat information warfare. Being aware of it is not enough. Combating information warfare is not only specific to public literacy and, you know, civil society. It's the government's ability to preempt and create counter narratives to basically discredit whatever it is that is going to be thrown at us, right? To anticipate these waves and to obstruct it. And that requires sophistication and strong institutions to do that. So we will see how we perform in 2026. We will see the amount of fracture and polarization and harm that has been inflicted on our democracy, because these things are going to happen. It's a question of magnitude. And based on that magnitude, we will then have a much better understanding of what we need to do to be even more resilient come 5 or 10 years from now.
Nerses, I have so many questions, but maybe since you're here, we're going to do a series of podcasts. Because, you know, we've talked about this, about how we are not seeing more democratic political parties being, you know, developed or coming into the political theater, if you will, because of the opposition who remains illiberal, who remains authoritarian, because the fear is if I dilute the vote, they're going to come to power. So these are, you know, fascinating things.
You know, we use the word polarization in a very generic way, but mm-hmm. structural polarization precisely favors these kinds of operations, because if local proxies completely consume the opposition ecosystem, they remain an important foundational base for operations by the Kremlin. But if you had a situation where, you know, the illiberal opposition has become a marginal actor, and in their place, the opposition is actually democratic forces that do engage in healthy discourse and do mm-hmm. challenge the government on policy issues, on substantive mm-hmm. issues.
Pace of reform, whatever. There's a million
that,
issues.
That categorically limits the toolkit of hybrid attacks. This is why pluralism is extremely, extremely important. You can't have the democratic consolidation without pluralism. You will be in a perpetual state of transition and find yourself in sort of this purgatory that I keep mentioning. We saw this in Georgia. Right. Yeah. Moldova is trying to get out of that trap. Ukraine even after Euromaidan, even after the Orange Revolution, saw these kinds of things. We saw this in Kyrgyzstan after the Tulip Revolution. I'm giving all these examples for us to see that democratic breakthrough isn't enough. Being a transitional democracy is not enough until you consolidate. And for you to have democratic consolidation, you have to have a pluralistic electoral field with institutionalized political parties that represent diversity of democratic interests. If you don't have that, you're going to have one or two groupings that represent democratic interests and an opposition that enhances and produces a more sophisticated anti-democratic discourse.
Wow. As always, thank you, Nerses, for this very illuminating conversation. We look forward to hearing you next month.
Always a pleasure.